Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Chicago, Illinois for a State of the Science Summit on lung cancer. At the meeting, faculty from the University of Chicago emphasized the impact of immunotherapy in non-small cell lung cancer, including the paradigm shift in the treatment of patients with stage 3 disease, promising combinations under exploration in stage 4 non-squamous disease, and key updates with the approach in stage 4 squamous disease. Other topics included promising agents that are accelerating advances made in the treatment of patients with ALK and ROS-positive disease, updates with targeted therapies in patients with molecular aberrations, and game-changing management approaches that have emerged in small cell lung cancer. First, we spoke with the chair of the meeting, Jyothi D. Patel, MD, FASCO, a professor of medicine and director of thoracic oncology at the University of Chicago Medicine. Patel told us that the use of immunotherapy in the frontline setting has led to tremendous benefit in patients with advanced non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, but these therapeutics should only be given in the absence of a driver mutation. Determining whether a patient has a genotypic driver present upfront will inform whether to proceed with immunotherapy or a targeted therapy, explained Patel. In our interview, Patel outlined what the current treatment paradigm looks like for patients with stage 4 non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, stressed the importance of genetic testing prior to the start of immunotherapy, and outlined key trials that have impacted the space.
Non-small cell lung cancer has undergone dramatic changes in the past several years. So for a large number of patients, we now find oncogene drivers and have targeted therapies. For patients without one of those well-established targets like EGFR or ALK or ROS1, there's some emerging targets that are pretty exciting like MET and RET, but the vast majority of people unfortunately don't have a targetable oncogene, and for that reason those patients are treated primarily with combinations of chemotherapy and immunotherapy or immunotherapy alone. Decisions about immunotherapy versus chemotherapy have to do on or deal with biology and tumor markers, as well as burden of disease and patient preference. The vast majority of patients, almost all patients, are eligible for immunotherapy up front, whether it's done as a single agent or with a chemotherapy backbone. We think it's absolutely essential to do genotyping, particularly to tease out drivers such as EGFR or ALK or ROS1. For those patients, we have oral agents that are remarkably effective and have long durations of response. Sometimes for someone with an ALK translocation, you're looking at several years on oral therapy that's well tolerated, that again is associated with a really deep response and tumor shrinkage. The issue is really one also of toxicity. So although there's enthusiasm to get therapy going for a patient, if one starts chemotherapy and immunotherapy up front, there have been some retrospective studies that have demonstrated if you switch to a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, there's an increase in toxicity. And real things like pneumonitis, colitis, hepatitis. And so one wants to know up front whether or not there's a genotropic driver. If you're looking at a tyrosine kinase inhibitor that has a higher response rate and duration of response in immunotherapy. If there's a high suspicion for a patient or you don't know because and you're feeling that you have to treat because of disease burden or progressive symptoms, then generally I'd say do chemotherapy alone after you find the answer, and if they don't have a driver, add immunotherapy at that juncture.
Speaking to the updates reported with the use of immunotherapy in patients with stage 4 squamous non-small cell lung cancer was Christine Besvina, MD, a thoracic oncologist from the University of Chicago. In our interview, Besvina highlighted some of the new options available for the treatment of squamous cell carcinoma of the lung, particularly the involvement of immunotherapy into the frontline setting.
I have heard people argue that based off of these results, it's no longer necessary to perform PD-L1 testing. I would certainly not support that. I think having that information available, particularly to determine if patients are PD-L1 high, is very important, because these patients may also be eligible to receive pembrolizumab monotherapy, which has an improved side effect profile and allows us to delay chemotherapy until later in their treatment when we may need it. For patients who are high PD-L1 or 50% or greater, my initial instinct is to go with pembrolizumab monotherapy. We don't have data comparing immunotherapy, monotherapy in this group versus chemoimmunotherapy, and I know that these patients tolerate the single agent treatment much better. However, for patients who are lower expression, 0 to 49%, I have a great deal of comfort in giving combination chemo plus immunotherapy, knowing that these patients are still going to derive benefit with the addition of immunotherapy. Additional research is going to be focused in narrowing down specifically what patients benefit from what therapies, in particular, kind of for patients who are high PD-L1 expressors, are there certain patients who really would benefit from the addition of chemotherapy, or can patients be treated with immunotherapy alone? Also to be factored in is at time of progression on immunotherapy, should the immunotherapy be continued, or should the immunotherapy be stopped and chemotherapy alone started? And that, I think, is a big area of exploration.
A new standard of care has emerged in the treatment of patients with locally advanced unresectable non-small cell lung cancer based on data from the randomized phase 3 Pacific trial, Everett E. Vokes, MD, told us when he stopped by. Initial data showed a 32% reduction in the risk of death with durvalumab compared with placebo in patients who had not progressed following concurrent chemoradiation, which led to the February 2018 approval of durvalumab. 3-year overall survival data showed a 31% reduction in the risk of death versus placebo. Despite this paradigm shift, questions remain with regard to sequencing strategies, Vokes said. In our interview, Vokes, the John E. Altman Professor of Medicine and Radiation Oncology, and Physician-in-Chief and Chair of the Department of Medicine at the University of Chicago Medicine, explained how the treatment of stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer has evolved over the years, and delved a little deeper into the unanswered questions prompted by Pacific.
What we know is that combined chemoradiation with simultaneous administration of the two is the standard of care. There are 3 regimens that can be used: carboplatin, cisplatin etoposide, and cisplatin pemetrexed. And beyond that, there was not a lot of progress. It's interesting, though, that with PET staging, outcomes improve. So there's more precise establishment of the exact stage, which leads to better outcome. And then institutions that have a higher volume tend to do better, which makes sense when you think about combined modality therapy and the coordination it requires between the various specialties and also the management of toxicities. So if that is the background and chemoradiotherapy is what we're talking about, then the Pacific trial is really the next big innovation. And it is fairly recent, but it's really transformative in many ways. The outcome of that was very dramatic. So the progression-free survival is a lot better for the patients who got the durvalumab than that group that got the placebo. And then similarly, the survival is better, with at 3 years about a 10% or so differential, if I recall correctly. It's about in that range, so quite substantial. So that's the new standard. The trial has subset analyses, and I think there are a number of them that are of interest. For one, patients that got the durvalumab early, so the end of chemo RT, and then within 2 weeks they start durvalumab, they seem to do better. And that could simply be those patients had smaller tumors, less complications, they simply got there earlier. It could also mean that giving the drug early is important. And you could make a theory around either one. That needs to be tested. The second one was, what about EGFR or otherwise mutated patients that were included? We don't really know the role of targeted therapies in stage 3 disease. Here, the group of patients with identified mutations is too small, so we don't have that analysis. It doesn't seem to me to be a worrisome outcome if you just look at raw numbers, but technically we don't know. A third question, is there one, has to do maybe with the timing. That's, I think, a big unanswered question. It relates to the first one. So if you give it afterwards and it's beneficial, should you also give it during chemo-RT, or maybe even before neoadjuvantly? And so those are sequencing questions that we look at, and we don't know the answer yet.
After delivering an interesting presentation on pathologic considerations in non-small cell lung cancer and the role of molecular testing, Jeremy Siegel, MD, PhD, Director of the Genomic and Molecular Pathologic Unit and Associate Professor of Pathology in the Department of Pathology at the University of Chicago, joined us to discuss the topic further. He told us that the future of molecular testing in non-small cell lung cancer lies in combined large-scale DNA and RNA analysis. He added that expanded sequencing can increase the detection of targetable mutations or molecular signatures and can also help to avoid misdiagnosis. In our interview, Siegel provided insight into the evolving role of molecular testing in non-small cell lung cancer, the different methods being utilized in practice, and future directions for testing.
Most of our test orders for molecular testing, they come from our oncologists, and it's not typically driven by pathology, although we have a nice agreement set up with our oncologists at U of C where any lung adenocarcinoma that comes through, it'll get automatically reflexed for testing, and then we'll do it. And so we've been seeing a lot of these cases, and we have a nice system that we use where we do sort of maybe an aggressive molecular analysis of all of these tumors. So we do a large-scale DNA panel, and we also do a large-scale RNA sequencing panel where we look for gene fusions. It's allowed us to see a variety of different things, and by sort of looking more expansively into these tumors, we've noted kind of repeatedly now that we've found some interesting things in cases. Sometimes it's been helpful for sorting out a tricky differential diagnosis between something and something else, or is it a metastatic tumor or a new metastasis or a new primary, or just some sort of spontaneous thing where we see something and then it helps us rethink the whole case. Is it not lung cancer at all? Is it a metastatic tumor from somewhere else? And we found a number of those, and it sort of made us, at least for me, rethink one of the main purposes of this testing. We went into this designing them to be biomarker tests for treatment, and they are that, and they're good at that, but they're also general pathology tools that we've been able to use in our pathology department because we have an integrated service where we do the pathology and we do the molecular testing too, and we talk about it and we can sort of compare notes on cases. It's helped us to rethink a number of these cases, and we've actually ended up changing the diagnosis for a decent subset of these patients. It's probably just a couple percent, but a couple percent is a lot of cancer patients. But we do a large-scale DNA next-generation sequencing panel where we sequence about 1,200 different genes. And we're doing that looking for mutations and copy number changes and tumor mutational burden and microsatellite instability and a bunch of other things. And we report the mutations from about 155 of those genes into the medical record, and we keep the rest of it for research purposes. So we do that. And then we also have an RNA sequencing assay that we run where we're sequencing the same 1,200 genes, but here we're sequencing it from RNA, so you can look and see if two genes are broken and put together in the wrong way, they will make a fusion RNA transcript that you can then tell, hey, wait a second, this gene is actually stuck to the wrong gene, and we can see that. And so technically we can find those types of fusions on a large number of genes then rather than just a couple. And so that's helpful too, because every once in a while there's some random weird thing that you might find in one of these cases. You're going to see that labs over time will do a larger and larger amount of analysis. Certain labs still do smaller gene panels. We do one of the larger ones But there are things coming out, commercial kits that are now helpful for having labs do larger amounts of sequencing. We have a consortium that we have built of sites that are working on expanding the amount of sequencing. There are certain things that you can only do if you sequence a larger number of genes. You can't do a very good job for tumor mutational burden if you're only looking at a small sliver of the genome. It's hard to find microsatellite instability in the same way. So allowing yourself to look more broadly opens up additional biomarkers, and the costs are going down of the sequencing, so it doesn't really cost that much to sequence more. The question is how much? I don't know. But certainly, like, moving into the RNA space seems worthwhile, and I think more and more labs will be doing that. It's just it's a little technically challenging to get into it, because RNA from formalin fixed tissue can be difficult to work with, but there are better and better methods coming out. So I think you'll see this sort of emphasis on a combined DNA and RNA analysis will be something that more labs do over the next few years. There's not too many labs doing it right now, but I think it will expand.
Long-awaited overall survival data have established osimertinib as the standard frontline agent for patients with EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer, Mary J. Fiddler, MD, told us when she stopped by. However, she added that there's room to improve upon osimertinib, whether that's through the addition of angiogenic agents or even chemotherapy. Updated data from the Phase 3 FLORA trial showed that treatment with osimertinib led to a median overall survival of 38.6 months versus 31.8 months with erlotinib or gefitinib in patients with EGFR-mutated non-small cell lung cancer. At 3 years of follow-up, 54% of patients who received osimertinib were alive, compared with 44% of those who received one of the first-generation TKIs, despite crossover between arms. In our interview, Fiddler highlighted the findings from the FLORA trial and the clinical implications of those data, explained how osimertinib differs from other available TKIs, and delved into other emerging approaches that are making waves in the paradigm.
The treatment landscape has evolved from our first generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors with a blip of increased activity looking at using the second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Specifically, there was data suggesting that perhaps some mutations benefited more than others, and then osimertinib became approved as a frontline option, and that has dramatically changed prescribing patterns in the United States based on improved progression-free survival, and now we know also overall survival compared with earlier generation gefitinib or erlotinib. So the FLORA trial was a frontline trial in EGFR mutation positive lung cancer patients. It was unique in that it allowed for patients who had brain metastases included. They had to be asymptomatic, but they didn't have to necessarily be treated with radiation. The randomization was to osimertinib, which is a third generation tyrosine kinase inhibitor, versus one of the first generation inhibitors, investigator's choice of erlotinib or gefitinib. The trial generated a huge amount of excitement with progression-free survival significance and a suggestion that overall survival may be significant in the future when it was presented last year at the European Medical Conference. This year we were lucky to see overall survival data. We saw that patients who were randomized to osimertinib over erlotinib or gefitinib had a longer overall survival, and this was about at the 3-year mark, which is exciting for our lung cancer patients. Unfortunately, this is usually a young, healthy patient population, so 3 years sounds great for physicians who've been treating lung cancer for many years, but we still have some work to do to change lung cancer into a chronic illness. So in the early studies, treating patients with osimertinib after they had progressed on earlier tyrosine kinase inhibitors, we saw a signal of brain activity. And we've seen it be beneficial for patients with leptomeningeal disease, which is a very hard patient population to treat. In the FLORA trial, where patients were randomized to osimertinib versus erlotinib or gefitinib, investigator's choice, about 20% of those patients had untreated brain metastases. And we saw disease control in the brain mirror what we saw in the body from the neck down, suggesting good CNS penetration. And patients were less likely to develop new brain metastases if they had received the osimertinib compared with one of the first generation agents.
Next, we sat down with Nisha A. Mohindra, MD, an assistant professor of medicine in the Hematology-Oncology Division of Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, to discuss promising agents that have emerged in ALK and ROS1 positive non-small cell lung cancer. Due to the development of selective TKIs, it's no longer a question of whether these diseases can be targeted, but rather how to choose which agent is optimal out of the arsenal of available treatments, Mohindra told us. In our interview, Mohindra walked us through the current treatment approaches being used for patients with non-small cell lung cancer who harbor these aberrations, and highlighted some of the next-generation inhibitors that may possess the potential to shift sequencing approaches.
In the ALK space, for first-line therapy, we certainly know the data from the ALEX trial, which suggests that alectinib has become a preferred agent in the U.S. We have crizotinib, and we have ceritinib for the first-line space. The Profile 1001 trial was the trial that looked at crizotinib in ALK, but it had a subset that looked at ROS1 positive disease. And basically what we saw was that there was response rates in the 70s with a PFS of about 17 plus months. And so I think that was the first time we saw a targeted agent in the ROS1 space, and it really changed the way to think about ROS1 as a targetable agent, a targetable disease. Entrectinib appears to be an NTRK, ROS1, and an ALK inhibitor. What we saw was there were three trials that had ROS1 patients treated with entrectinib, and there was an integrated analysis which pulled all these ROS1 patients. There were about 54 patients that were pulled in that analysis, and we saw that the response rates were about 77%, and PFS for the population as a whole was about 19 months. The duration of response was close to 25 months. So what we took away was this was another promising agent for the first-line space. An important distinction between entrectinib and crizotinib is that entrectinib appears to have improved CNS efficacy. The two agents have never actually been compared to one another, but it is another very exciting option for the first-line space for ROS1 disease. In my ALK-positive patients, I'm generally selecting alectinib as my first-line agent. I think with the ALEX trial, we really saw an unprecedented progression-free survival, and we haven't seen that in many of the targeted agents, so that has become my preferred agent for first-line. Certainly at the time of progression, we're learning that resistance to these ALK TKIs is complex, and understanding the mechanism of resistance really will play into understanding what the next line of treatment should be. And then for my ROS1 patients, I do think that entrectinib has become an exciting option for them and will likely become my preferred agent for treatment.
We closed out the evening with Lawrence E. Feldman, MD, who told us that after decades of minimal progress, recent regulatory updates with checkpoint inhibitors have generated excitement in extensive stage small cell lung cancer treatment. For example, an update of the Phase 3 EMPOWER 133 trial presented at the 2019 ESMO Congress showed that the median overall survival remained 12.3 months with the addition of atezolizumab to carboplatin plus etoposide, compared with 10.3 months with carboplatin etoposide alone at a median follow-up of 22.9 months. Furthermore, the Phase 3 Caspian trial showed a similar overall survival improvement with durvalumab plus carboplatin and etoposide versus carboplatin and etoposide alone. Specifically, median overall survival was 13 months compared with 10.3 months respectively. In our interview, Feldman, a professor of clinical medicine at the University of Illinois Cancer Center, explained what the current treatment of small cell lung cancer looks like and the impact of immunotherapy on the space.
It's been really four decades since we've had any major progress in the management of small cell lung cancer, so it's refreshing to be able to speak about some of the recent findings that are actually practice changing in the case of small cell lung cancer. It compromises about 15% of lung cancer overall, and it's mainly seen in smokers. I talked about the staging system, which is now we're encouraged to stage these patients as we do with non-small cell lung cancer using the AJCC staging system. And then Having said that, we do differentiate between patients who have limited stage versus extensive stage disease. About one-third have limited stage and two-thirds have extensive stage disease. And so for extensive stage disease, I went into some of the recent trials, such as the IMPOWER 133 trial using atezolizumab plus standard carboplatinum and etoposide. And then I also talked about the recent presentation at the World Lung Meeting in Barcelona on the Caspian trial, looking at platinum etoposide plus durvalumab versus platinum etoposide alone. And both of those studies that I mentioned did show a overall survival advantage with the addition of a checkpoint inhibitor. And so that's really become, I believe, the standard of care in terms of treating extensive stage small cell lung cancer. And then I go into some of the research that is going on in this setting of limited stage lung cancer with chemo, immunotherapy, and radiation therapy. And at our institution, we participate in the NRG Lung 005 trial, which is looking at chemo immunotherapy plus radiation versus chemotherapy plus radiation alone as a control arm. And in that case, the checkpoint inhibitor that's being looked at is atezolizumab in combination with platinum etoposide and radiation. And then I go into second line therapy, looking at the CheckMate 032 trial with nivolumab or nivolumab plus ipilimumab in the second line setting, which is now listed in the NCCN guidelines as a potential treatment for second line treatment. And then also some of the research studies looking at combination immunotherapy in the second line setting that we're participating, particularly we have a Big Ten Cancer Research Consortium trial, which is looking at a drug called plinabulin plus ipilimumab and nivolumab.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have two upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to learn more about cutting-edge treatment strategies in gastrointestinal cancers, register for the December 17th State of the Science Summit in Miami, Florida. We will also be holding a State of the Science Summit on Hematologic Malignancies on December 19th in Columbus, Ohio. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.